It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. Earlier this month, Wilkinsburg School District's acting superintendent Dan Matsuk dispelled a rumor that the middle school and high school would be closing by announcing that those schools will remain open for the 2015-16 school year. But the future beyond that remains in question. As part of our Life of Learning initiative, we look at how a small school district in a low-income community can survive and hopefully thrive. Joining us in studio is the acting superintendent for the Wilkinsburg School District, Dr. Dan Matsuk. Dan Matsuk, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
If you have a question for the superintendent or a comment, you can call us at 412-246-2002, 412-246-2002. Email at ESSPGH@WESA.FM or tweet us at ESSPGH. Dan, there have been talks with other districts. What was the nature of those discussions? Which districts? Was Penn Hills, Woodland Hills, Pittsburgh Public Schools? What can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you that the board, we discussed, or I brought an idea to the board about taking a look at the idea of a partnership as opposed to an idea of a merger or tuition. And, of course, it's a new concept because with a partnership, it's a softer term. And we felt that, well, we need to bounce this off of some potential neighbors. So our neighbors, obviously, who border us are Penn Hills, Woodland Hills, and Pittsburgh Public. And the plan was, and that we set in motion, was to meet with representatives from the districts and to talk about the pros and cons of what this partnership could potentially be. What would be the hurdles? What would be the questions you would want answered? There was no intent in any of these particular early, very casual conversations to make offers of anything, as was reported in the paper. That was one of the reasons why we wanted to have a public meeting back on May 7th, is to dispel rumors that we were out looking to pay someone to take our kids. And maybe when you strip it all the way down to dollars and cents, people may look at it that way. But the bottom line is, this is more about the concept of us working together to do what's best for the students in Wilkinsburg and hopefully something that can complement one of our potential partners.
How far did those discussions get? Are they ongoing?
Well, the discussions, the status right now, as you read, the Penn Hills discussions never really took off. There was a meeting scheduled that was canceled a couple days before it was supposed to happen. So we never really had discussions there. And I believe if you've been reading the newspapers about Penn Hills, they have some issues going on there that they felt they needed to focus in on.
They have financial troubles?
Yes. And the other side of us is Woodland Hills. And in talks with representatives from Woodland Hills, basically we found out, as was reported accurately, they're looking to consolidate their elementary schools next year as well as bring their 7th and 8th graders into their high school. So, you know, those types of plans trump, you know, taking a look outside their boundaries, which made sense. The disappointing thing that happened from those two talks was that, unfortunately, what was reported in the paper is something we didn't want reported in the paper, and that was headlines that says such and such district doesn't want Wilkinsburg students. We want to keep our students out of this. We don't want them caught in a crossfire. So the headline was very hurtful to us, and so we felt we needed to go public to talk about what our real story was. To go back to your original question about our partners, we did have, again, conversations with Pittsburgh Public School representatives. And again, the conversations were, as I described earlier, what would be the hurdles, the roadblocks, how can we make it work, what would keep it from working, what are things we need to be concerned about. And we had those discussions, and all those discussions took place between February and, I want to say, the end of March, maybe the beginning of April. And the status of the Pittsburgh Public School one is that basically they took the information to take back to their leadership to take a look at it to see whether or not there's a need for us to have another meeting.
Mm-hmm. At that news conference, you could not commit that the high school, would stay open beyond another year. And so, in a sense, if they don't, your kids who are done with elementary would have to go somewhere else. So did two and two get put together and come up with not the four or what. So, I mean, that has to be what you're talking about in case the middle and high school have to close.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the board made a conscious decision. We had a little bit of money that was borrowed for capital projects, and about $6.5 million was left of that money, and it was either give back that money and pay penalties, you know, for having the money, or let's not sit on our hands and do something with it. So we decided, as a group of 10, that let's make the investment into the foundation of the Wilkinsburg school system. And we looked at options. The options that we looked at were, let's renovate and use that money for just our pre-K through 6 buildings. We have two elementary buildings, Kelly Elementary and Turner Elementary. Each one has 350 students. The other has 250 students in it. The other option we looked at was a pre-K through 8 building, expanding those two elementary buildings to put 7th and 8th graders and keep them in the district as well. We looked at that option. And the third option we looked at was, how can we spend the money pre-K through 12, and what would it cost us to do those things? The obvious answer was that, you know, each one of those options cost the district a bit more money, which means we would have to borrow a lot more money, and our borrowing capacity was very limited. So the board made the commitment to, let's hold on to our identity with our elementary schools. We borrowed an additional $4 million, so our elementary schools for the 16-17 school year will be state-of-the-art with technology. Our elementary schools will be all the safety features that you see in any school district across the country will be implemented into our elementary schools' facilities, and we're going to improve the appearance of those buildings, because they're very, very old buildings and they don't look like schools. So those are the three goals, to spend the $10 million as most frugally as we possibly can to get the biggest bang for our buck, which begged the question, so what's going on with 7 through 12? And that's when we began to think about this idea of a partnership concept.
Okay. If you have a question or comment for our guest, the acting superintendent of the Wilkinsburg School District, Dr. Dan Metzuk, you can give us a call at 412-246-2002. Dan, you've used the term partnership or partner several times in our conversation so far. So what are you looking for from a partner in terms of programs, services that maybe Wilkinsburg can't offer, or you want to be assured that the students are offered elsewhere?
The most important thing we're looking for in a partnership, in our partner, a potential partner, is opportunities for our students. Not just opportunities in terms of curriculum. You know, one of the things we presented at our public meeting on May 7th was the difference between the course offerings we offer at Wilkinsburg versus course offerings you see at either Pittsburgh Public or a Woodland Hills or a Penn Hills. These are large districts. It's night and day what we offer our students curriculum-wise. The other sense of opportunities we want our students, we believe in educating the whole child. So activities are extremely important to us. We want our students to be able to get involved in more. We're only going to have 3 sports next year. We're eliminating girls basketball or girls volleyball. Okay, we're eliminating baseball next year. So we want our students to be able to have access to not just the traditional football, basketball, track and field experience, and we want our students to be able to be involved in the musical, in the drama club, all the other clubs that are involved. We offer French as one language. That's all we offer. You know, our students need to be able to have access to other languages. Now, we did, just so a lot of people don't understand us, we do look into online courses. We've looked into partnerships where, you know, we can share a Spanish teacher, those types of things, with technology the way it is today. And those ideas are fine. Those innovative ideas are fine. I mean, they've been around for a long time. And if you look very closely, you only see those types of ideas complementing and supplementing the main thrust of what school districts do, a traditional school does. So it's very important to us when we say partnership, the partner got to offer us a full slate of educational and athletic and arts types of opportunities for our students.
I believe the current enrollment for the Wilkinsburg School District is 855. It has been declining. Is this due to a decreasing population of school-age kids in the community, or is it due to charter schools, other education opportunities, options, or some other factor?
Well, there's a number of factors that it's due to, and, of course, you can check the box on all the ones that you just mentioned. We do have a bit of a dwindling population, but we're mostly hit by the fact that we have an exodus into charter schools, K through 12. We have 342 students who attend charter schools from their Wilkinsburg students, of which about 200 of those, which is what, almost two-thirds of those, from grades 7 through 12. Once they get out of the elementary school, there's an acceleration of an exodus of students who don't want to go into the middle school, high school building. Now, so there's that. And, of course, you have your parochial private schools that are out there as well. So we're losing population for a lot of different reasons. And we stressed at our public meeting, Kevin, that, you know, the troubles that Wilkinsburg's having today, this did not happen overnight. It took decades for us to get to where we are. And I can tell you that there's a lot of blame to go around. You can check a lot of boxes on why we got to where we are. But our focus isn't on that. Our focus is on, we have, think about this, in grades 9 through 12, 150 students, and an additional 85 in grades 7 and 8. They're sitting in a 2.5-mile square mile district, very small, with three big brothers all around them that have literally hundreds, maybe thousands of opportunities at their disposal, and our kids have no access to any of that.
The big brothers, Woodland Hills, Penn Hills, and Pittsburgh Public Schools.
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned that number of students in charter schools. That's better than 25% of your school-age kids in charters. How does that compare percentage-wise with other districts, do you know?
Well, percentage-wise, we're either the top, we're either at the very top or in the top three. You know, we have a $27 million budget, and we spend a little over $5 million on charter school tuition. So it takes a big, big chunk out of our, you know, out of our financial operations. And so, yeah, we're at the top. And, again, now we are, I am particularly, I mean, parents, they have, I mean, I'm fine with choice, okay? However, we want to make sure that our students can choose opportunity, and the ones that are in our district right now, in our middle school, high school, they don't have much choice. You know, they need opportunity, and that's what we're looking for.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin in for Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Wilkinsburg School District Acting Superintendent Dan Matsuk. If you have a question, call us at 412-246-2002. You can also email us, ESSPGH@WESA.FM, or reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH. A couple numbers that I have from the Department of Education. Wilkinsburg High's graduation rate last year, I believe, was 62.5%. Statewide average, 85.5%. All four Wilkinsburg schools, the two elementaries, the middle and high school, are among the 15% lowest achieving in math and reading statewide. But district-wide, three of every four students are economically disadvantaged. Dan, how do those two factors, achievement and economics, go hand in hand?
Well, I think if you follow the research, it's common sense that if you follow the money, you will see that oftentimes the highest achieving schools fall along the lines of, you know, where the wealth is. There's definitely a correlation there. And that's not an excuse, but it's a fact that people need to understand. There are challenges related to presenting and delivering educational services in poverty-stricken areas, that those challenges do not exist in other districts. And there are special circumstances that basically hinder some of the good practices that many educators put forward in order to make a difference with students. There's a lot of transiency in our district. We have students who come in and out constantly throughout the course of a year. These are just factors that I'm pointing out to you. They are not excuses. So we are aware of those factors. And be honest with you, oftentimes our staff, our teaching staff and our administrators don't get the credit that they deserve for fighting the extra battle that they have to fight in order to get, and maybe that's not a good way of saying it, fighting a battle, but handling the extra challenge of working with students who don't have a lot of resources at their fingertips. So those stories go unnoticed because, you know, obviously you also can't ignore, you cannot ignore that, you know, our achievement scores are where they should be. Although in our elementary schools last year, especially at Turner, we had a huge bump in our SPP scores. And at Kelly, we had a bump in our SPP scores as well. So little steps are giant steps for us. And we're excited about, we think that we've implemented some practices this year. And with the innovations that we're putting into the renovations we're putting into our elementary schools and our technology upgrades that we're doing in our district should impact our rates of decreasing the achievement gap a little faster.
And that technology includes the iPads for the elementary school students.
Yes, we have next year every student in the grades pre-K through 6 will have an iPad. You know, we are real excited about the fact that you know, we have a one-to-one initiative with students being able to use technology that, you know, you would never think you would be able to do a one-to-one in a district that doesn't that has some financial issues. But we were able to secure some grant money and tie it into improving student achievement. And we're excited about seeing what some of the results are going to be as we monitor the effectiveness of these programs.
Another school district in a low-income community, which was academically troubled, Duquesne, closed its high school in 2007, sending their students to East Allegheny and West Mifflin. 5 years later, the 7th and 8th graders were sent to neighboring districts, or parents received a voucher to go to another school. Is this an inevitable trend for smaller, economically disadvantaged school districts?
I can tell you that it's unless something changes with the funding formula, the things that are going on in Harrisburg, whether they're within the Department of Education or legislative hands, which most of us is in, we're going to see more of this happen. You know, the current formula is very complicated. We don't have enough time on your show to get into the complicated factors that go into that particular formula, but it's a trend that you would be surprised. I believe there are a lot more schools out there that are in much worse shape than Wilkinsburg in terms of their finances. We're going to pass a balanced budget this year, and we anticipate a balanced budget for next year because of some of the good leadership and planning that's been done by our business manager and our school board. But I can tell you there's a lot of districts out there that can't say the same thing, and if it doesn't change, you're going to see a lot more people looking for innovative ideas to merge, to tuition, to partner, to consolidate. All those words are going to be common words across the country.
In fact, the Basic Education Funding Commission is to make its recommendations, I believe, next month to the legislature on a funding formula. Just a few minutes left. I wanted to get this. You were a point person, a leader in the voluntary merger of the Center Area and Monaca school districts in 2009-10, and you were the first superintendent of the new district, Central Valley. Is merger even an option for Wilkinsburg?
I believe there's some hurdles that are associated with mergers that can hinder them from happening or prolong them to the point where, you know, the district that's struggling will continue to nosedive. And I think in our particular case, we're looking for a voluntary partnership to make decisions, to collaborate, to come together before there's a collapse. We're on the watch list right now and heading towards a distressed list in the next couple of years. We bought some time, 18 to 24 months, we bought some time. However, you know, mergers work in some cases. They don't work in others. And all school districts are different. So it's and I tell people that all the time. They see me coming. They say, there's the merger guy. Look out. You know, that's what he wants to do. Well, no. That's not what we want to do. We want to do what's best for both communities or whatever communities are involved. And merger isn't necessarily the right thing. In our case, our board wants to maintain their elementary, safe neighborhood, walk-to-school buildings, and they want to find a way to offer hundreds of opportunities to their older kids that we cannot afford to offer right now.
Just about a minute remaining. what will take for a small district in a low-income community to survive, but also thrive, not just survive, but thrive in some form. Is it just elementary schools, or is it all the way from pre-K to grade 12? Or is that a district-by-district question?
It's probably a district-by-district question. I can tell you that in Wilkinsburg case, if the partnership happens for us, we will thrive at the elementary level, and we'll and our students will experience the same educational opportunities as our peers in Allegheny County.
And finally, when will a long-range decision be made about the future of the Wilkinsburg District regarding middle and high school?
Well, in order for things to happen for 16-17 school year, that decision, that final decision-making window is pretty narrow. It's the next 3 or 4 months. I can't see it going past the next 6 months. So something's got to happen. Something's got to give. So we're getting prepared because we have to prepare students for transition for 16-17. We can't make a decision and think we're going to send students somewhere in 30 days. We have to do a lot of – this is about the kids, and they can't get lost in this whole decision-making process.
Dan Matzuk is the acting superintendent of the Wilkinsburg School District. Thank you, and good luck to you, the students, and the parents in the district.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you calling me in.
Coming up, ongoing crises and natural disasters are causing a need for humanitarian aid workers. The local college is trying to prepare and train them. That's next on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. April 25th, an earthquake devastates Nepal, killing nearly 9,000 people. 3 weeks later, another quake strikes Nepal, another 100 fatalities. That's in addition to the injured and the thousands left homeless and in need of humanitarian assistance. Citizens often respond generously to such appeals for monetary help, but others might want to get more directly involved. For a second straight summer, La Roche College is offering the Global Development and Humanitarian Aid Training Program. Joining us in studio is Charlotte Reed, the Assistant Director of Global Engagement at La Roche, who has international experience working with former child soldiers in Peru and Colombia. Charlotte Reed, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much for having us.
Also joining us is James Stockstill, an immigration attorney who worked with Doctors Without Borders in Ethiopia, South Sudan, Zimbabwe, Nigeria, and Nepal, and for a UN-led reform of the education system for Palestinians. He's also a faculty member with the La Roche Humanitarian Aid Training Program. James Stockstill, welcome as well.
Thanks for having us.
If you have a question or comment for our guest, please call us at 412-246-2002, email esspgh@wesa.fm, or tweet us at esspgh. I'll put this to either or both of you. How great of a need is there for humanitarian workers in the field, on site, on the front lines, if you want to call it that? Or is it coordinators of assistance back at the organization's headquarters or offices? I'll ask both of you. Charlotte, we'll start with you.
I mean, I would say that there's a great need for both. And at this point in the world, unfortunately, it's only a growing need and doesn't seem like it's going to be slowing down anytime soon. So the humanitarian aid sector, both on in the ground and on the field and then back in the policy side of things, there's just a growing need in the sector in general.
Mm-hmm. James?
Well, I think the need, certainly there's more people paying attention to it nowadays. But I think maybe the field has remained static, but what we see the change in is the need for professionalization. And that hasn't been the case, you know, at the time where something like Doctors Without Borders was founded and you had this idea of the renegade doctors going to help people in Biafra. But now the world is different and you need more preparation, more courses, and there's best practices that we need to teach people how to do.
It's interesting. You used the term professionalize it. I mean, I guess the workers were sort of good-hearted, but they just didn't have the training. They wanted to get involved, but they need training so that they can be as effective as possible. Is that fair, Charlotte?
Yes, but I think also they learned from each other. And so what's happening with these best practices is that over the course of the past couple decades, the profession of humanitarian aid has grown and people have learned from mistakes and from what has worked. And so they've created something called the Sphere Handbook, the guidebook, which was published in 2011 and really tells people how to engage in humanitarian aid in specific settings, how many houses or, you know, shelters need to be set up and what needs to be done. But that needs to get taught in order to then be implemented.
Did you notice that, James, the need for greater professionalism, whether it was in China or in Africa or in the Middle East?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have a lot of organizations out there, like you said, a lot of good-hearted people wanting to do whatever they can to help. But a lot of times people end up just serving themselves instead of serving the population in need. So to create guidelines or to create professionalization within your own organizations only serves the true purpose and bringing people out of the suffering that caused you to be there.
So you sensed a need for better trained workers and created this program. This, I mentioned, the second year, correct?
Yes.
Did you change anything from year one to year two?
We are trying to improve, obviously, but it worked last year. And so much of what we're offering has a similar guidance, at least, a similar structure. The only major change that we've made is we added an optional online component so that for people that might not be able to come for a full 2 weeks to La Roche, there's an option to do an online coursework through an organization called Humanitarian U and then spend a week at La Roche. And we're pretty excited about that as a new collaboration.
What are you looking forward to, the improvement, James, as a faculty member, as I mentioned?
Well, I love the students. And when you get a group of students in there who are from college graduates to maybe mid-career changing professionals, people with this geographic dispersion from Africa or from Pittsburgh or from Asia, and as well people maybe who have worked in the field before coming in and they share their knowledge. And that's going to change from year to year regardless. But our faculty members aren't just like myself, now an immigration attorney, used to be an aid professional, but there are people working out in the field right now who have been working in the Ebola crisis, who have been working in Nepal, who are going to come back and interact with the students and create those lifelong connections.
How many were certified last year? Were they in the field, hands-on with recipients? Give us an idea, Charlotte.
At this point, last year we had about 15 people get to go through the program and be certified, and now they are there. We have a Facebook page for just them, and they stay in touch and are working on the ground. Many came from home countries in other places and have now returned to those host countries and are working in the field.
So they're working in their home countries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, they understand that's what they care about and they understand the culture.
A lot of the international applicants that we have are currently working where they're from and want this professionalization and or want this sort of development in their careers, and so they're looking to come get the certification and then go back and be better at what they're doing in their home country.
James, let's talk a little bit more about who are these applicants. Are they looking for careers in humanitarian aid? You mentioned a little bit about background, you know, the college grads, maybe a mid-career change. Were they volunteers, you know, typical organizations, Red Cross, maybe even Peace Corps? Who are these people that really want to take part and actually do something?
Well, I don't know this year's student body yet, but just speaking for last year's, we had one woman who works locally at Global Links, the nonprofit,
right,
and who is interested in learning more, not just working domestically, but seeking to go international as well. We had people, one standout, we were talking about it before we came in here, a fellow working for ADRA, the Adventist Development Relief Agency, who's a Kenyan who is working in Somalia. And so he's someone with a great deal of international experience. He brought it to the group, and what he sought was that certification, something to put on his resume, which gives him more validity when he seeks to go take it to the next level, something management-related or going to a large organization like the UN.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin in for Paul Guggenheimer. Our guests are Charlotte Reed, Assistant Director of Global Engagement at La Roche College, and Immigration Attorney James Stockstill, who has worked with humanitarian aid organizations in Asia and Africa. They serve on the faculty of La Roche College's Humanitarian Aid Training Program. If you have a question, you can call us at 412-246-2002. You can also email us at esspgh@wesa.fm or reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH. To either or both of you, do people get inspired to to get involved, to do something when they hear about the natural disasters and, of course, the most recent, the earthquakes in Nepal? And if so, is that why you extended, I believe you extended your application deadline?
Yes. I mean, I definitely think when people hear about this and you see the stories and you see it unfolding, you recognize the need. And so we wanted to extend our application deadline to allow for that. And so it is still open, and we have a few spots left. At this point, with visa requirements and the challenges of international applicants, we're looking more at domestic just because it's hard to get a visa within, 3 weeks. But we definitely saw an uptick in interest after the earthquakes, both in just people interested in what we were doing and also in those that wanted to apply and see how they could get involved.
Mm-hmm. You offer three levels of training in this program. Can you tell us what the differences are and what does each certification, shall we say, qualify the individual to do?
Sure. So the first thing that we're offering is it's a 5-day course, and that's in collaboration with an organization called Red R UK. And they are a very well-known international organization that provides certification throughout the world. They're offering one other certification in the United States this summer, but it's focused on security. So we're the only location in the U.S. this summer that's really doing the fundamentals of humanitarian aid. So that's our first option. The second is an extended program that's the Red R Week in La Roche, at La Roche, and then a secondary week at La Roche with our additional faculty, where we're really pulling from local experts that are working in the field or have, like James, to go more in depth into specific areas such as program management, the ethics of humanitarian aid, cultural diversity, things like that. And then the third option is the new option for this year, which is the online course that you would complete before attending, and then you would continue for the extended week at La Roche. So it would be the second week part, having completed the first week, the first online course, as opposed to doing the Red R.
How much can you simulate of a disaster, of a need?
Very little. I mean, so much changes from day to day in a disaster, and it's not always just disasters. In fact, rarely it is. You're looking at development. You're looking at longer-term humanitarian needs. But what we try and do is to give people the basic tools that they can use no matter what they face when they hit the ground. I had attended a course similar to this one in Switzerland before I went on my first mission with Doctors Without Borders in Ethiopia. I arrived in the middle of a huge cholera outbreak, obviously something I hadn't been exposed to being in the U.S. And the tools that I had learned just helped me cope with that until I could get to know the location itself and get to know the population. Things like security or project management or ethics, these are going to apply regardless of where you are or what you're doing.
I think also there's a language of humanitarian aid and the way people talk and the way people interact and the ideas of the ethics or what how organizations interact or even just the acronyms and things like that. And you're not going to know exactly the situation you're getting into until you're on the ground, but at least having that background knowledge and being able to speak to talk the talk at least would gives you a leg up and makes you much more hit the ground running.
I want to follow up on something you both alluded to, and has to do with ethics and culture. And how much of your training involves the importance of learning and understanding how to interact with people of different cultures? And when it's an ongoing crisis, you can plan for that. But if it's a response to a natural disaster, unless you've figured out every single possible place that can have a natural disaster, so how do you get people to understand about the cultural and be appreciative and sensitive to cultural differences?
Well, I think regardless of the situation that you find yourself in, this is going to be number one because you have to focus on a team. And it's not just you going out there. Your team is what supports you, and it's made up of various cultures. You have to focus on that in our situations where you are working with your team in Darfur, you're working with your team in Haiti. Even this project management requires this simulation where you have to figure out this different steps. People have different ideas. They're bringing their different backgrounds into play. So to answer your question succinctly, it's everything. This this different cultural aspect is the most important thing you'll find in the training and in the reality on the ground as well.
And we do have a course. We will be teaching a section. I mean, you can't go into as much depth as you need to for cultural relativism or being aware, but we will be touching on being aware of the needs of respecting the culture, because, you know, who you give the food to or how you hand out food or what health concerns you're aware of, that all depends on the context that you're in. And so it is critical.
Okay, let's go to a caller. Andrew in Fraser Township, you have a question for our guests.
Yes, hi. Appreciate you taking the call, and I have been interested in finding a program that you're like what you're talking about for some time. I happen to be in career transition right now, and so the timing would be good if I could get on board with the program. And I didn't know, I guess twofold, do you have anything to, you know, talk about tuition assistance? And the other question would be, do you have anything in place that would help with networking in fulfilling this career once the training is completed?
Andrew, thank you very much.
So I will start with your questions about tuition and all of that, and pass it along to James. We do not have a huge amount of tuition assistance because we actually keep – this is a mission-based program for La Roche, and so we keep the costs basically just trying to break even, because we want to make it eligible. We want everyone to be able to attend. And so ours is the least expensive of all the programs out there. But you will find on our website which is laroche.edu/humanitarian, my contact information, and we're always willing to discuss with people what their needs are and how we can attempt to, you know, work together and see how we could help you out. So I would suggest that you reach out to me, and we could then, you know, have that discussion. But James will talk a little bit about the networking, I think.
Yeah, as far as the networking, other than the other students in the classroom, each of the professors has their own professional background, working with a number of organizations, Doctors Without Borders, UN, Concern International, Oxfam, and through them is how you get your foot in the door. You show up in the class, you engage people, and you'll find that good things come from it.
I think like anywhere, networks are really what makes the world work in that situation, and so it's not only the professors, but also the other classmates that you would be meeting and working with in the program, or who would then become your professional network.
30 seconds left. The need for humanitarian assistance doesn't seem to be diminishing at all. So do you anticipate La Roche's humanitarian aid training program to continue?
Yes, we have lots of plans and high hopes for it. So we see this as something that will continue to, you know, hopefully enrich the Pittsburgh community, but also the international one.
Thank you very much. Charlotte Reed is the Assistant Director of Global Engagement at La Roche College. James Stockstill is an immigration attorney who's worked for UN organizations in several countries, as well as Doctors Without Borders. He's also a faculty member with La Roche's Humanitarian Aid Training Program. Charlotte Reed, James Stockstill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, service projects that aim to transform schools into healthy, high-performing, cost-efficient learning places. That's when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. Paul Guggenheimer is off. I'm Kevin Gavin. Here's a twist on the traditional apple for the teacher. How about a Green Apple Day of Service for the entire school? The fourth annual Green Apple Day of Service is Thursday. It's an international service event developed by the U.S. Green Building Council's Center for Green Schools and gives teachers, students, parents, and the community a chance to help their local schools through service projects. Events are coordinated in our region by the Green Building Alliance. And joining us in studio to discuss the Green Apple Day of Service is Andrew Ellsworth, director of the Green and Healthy Schools Academy, an initiative of the Green Building Alliance. Andrew Ellsworth, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
And along with Andrew is Jennifer Bales, director of marketing and public relations for the Community Day School, who has organized activities for previous Green Apple Days of Service. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you, Kevin.
Community organizations, they've been partnering with schools for years, such as libraries, museums, and the like. So why did the Green Building Alliance want to get involved? We'll start with you, Andrew.
Well, we see a real opportunity. The Green Building Alliance and the Green and Healthy Schools Academy in particular has a goal of fostering the 21st century citizens and 21st century learners, the ones that can be civically engaged and take on the challenges of tomorrow. And for that, we do need 21st century schools today. So what we see is these service projects are a great opportunity for students and community members to really get engaged and get involved and get connected with an issue that they feel strongly about in a way to do so that has an impact, that has a positive impact on their school and on the community around it.
Okay. We talked a little bit about service projects. What's the intent of the projects? Transform schools into healthy, safe, high-performing, cost-efficient learning places. Let's talk in general, and Jennifer, specifically, your involvement.
So we are a Jewish day school in Squirrel Hill, and the commandment of Bal Tashchit, which means do not destroy or waste in Hebrew, is very central to the Jewish environmental ethic, and it's a core value of our school. I'm also a parent at our school, so I care really deeply about the health and well-being of where my kids spend the bulk of their waking hours. And so for us to get involved with the Green Apple Day of Service was fantastic because it was an easy, inexpensive way in sort of a bite-sized chunk that we could take action to make a real difference in our community and show our kids that they could, that small actions make a big difference.
Andrew, it seems like the mission of the community day school fits in very well with the broader goal of the whole Green Apple Day of Service.
Absolutely. And we're excited to have partnered with Community Day School in helping them in whatever way possible. And honestly, this is not about us, the Green and Healthy Schools Academy. This is about the schools and this is about the communities. So we see the work that we do around the Green Apple Day of Service and more in particular, the Green Apple Day of Service Idea Exchange, which is what's happening on Thursday, as a way of empowering and connecting schools with resources and with organizations that can help them accomplish these service projects.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. As part of WESA's Life of Learning initiative, we're discussing the upcoming Green Apple Day of Service taking place this Thursday. Our guests are Andrew Ellsworth, director of the Green and Healthy Schools Academy for the Green Building Alliance, and Jennifer Bales. She's the director of marketing and public relations for the Community Day School. And give us some examples of projects last year and how they met intended goals.
So over the last several years, we've seen projects pop up all around the region in neighborhoods such as Manchester or Homewood, Monroeville, Sheridan. And they really pick up on something that the community cares about. It might be a solar energy art installation or a harvest garden party, studying native plants, taking a tour of a green community, studying waste and waste reduction and the science of garbage. I think these are small projects. They're only 1 or 2 day projects, but they're really intended as a supplement to the what happens in the classroom. And the service learning is that connection between the classroom and the community and a way to get them involved and get them learning by doing.
I mentioned the 4th annual Green Apple Day of Service. Jennifer, how long has the Community Day School been involved?
We got started last fall, and our parents and students decided that they wanted to do a project to improve air quality in the Pittsburgh area. Our city is certainly overburdened with a risk of disease due to poor air quality, and they thought they'd look within our own neighborhood. So our kids went out, and they did an anti-idling project for clean. They called it Clean Air Matters Week, and so they educated our bus drivers about diesel idling regulations as pertains to Allegheny County. They asked parents to turn off their engines in the carpool line, and they sweetened the deal with donuts and coffee for the bus drivers and some candy for the parents, along with the medicine of their education about idling.
Well, you know, it's interesting. And I'd like both of you to address this. I don't want to say using the, but the kids doing something, not just, but they can see that their efforts can make a difference. And you mentioned 1 or 2 day project, but it can make a difference in a short amount of time. We'll start with you, Jennifer.
Yeah, I'm going to just read you a quote, if that's okay, from one of our students who was 8 years old, who said, "Small numbers make big numbers, small things make a big difference." And that was just after one afternoon of passing out information about idling, so they really could see the power of the agency of their own voice in taking action. And I'm sure Andrew's seen that over and over again.
Absolutely. And the purpose of the Green Apple Day of Service is to say that you don't need a lot of money and a huge staff to accomplish something. And these little wins do add up. And at the end of the day, a quote that we like to use, I believe it's from Bill Strickland, is you got to brighten your own corner. And so everyone pitching in and doing something that they care about is going to add up and is going to make a difference, whether it's reducing air emissions or whether it's demonstrating to other people in the community that things we can have a vision of something better.
Andrew, you used the term 1 or 2 day projects. I'd like both of you to address this. And although they're it might be 1 or 2 day projects, can this be sort of a catalyst for a long-term or continuing project? Jennifer?
Yeah, absolutely. So this year we realized that parents needed continuing education about their behavior in the carpool line. And so our parent association funded some anti-idling signs. We've taken on composting in our cafeteria, and also our third grade held a not-so-peaceful protest about idling this year. So they've continued the work, and it's been exciting to see the kids take ownership.
Andrew?
Well, absolutely. We set up these projects as a way to get people involved and to find something that they care about. And when people start to care about something and they connect with something, they're going to keep doing it. And so it's different than saying, I want you to sign up for a 1 year program. You know, all of a sudden people are going to back away a little bit and say, well, I don't have time. But this is a way to dip your toe in and to, you know, find the type of project that's interesting to you. In our event that's coming up on Thursday, which is at the Union Project called the Green Apple Day of Service Idea Exchange, we brought together over a dozen nonprofits, each developing a separate service project idea that people can sign up for, whether it's a student, whether it's a teacher, whether it's a parent, that then they can go and implement. So they can find the project that is meaningful to them.
So this, as I mentioned, is the fourth annual Green Apple Day of Service, but the Idea Exchange is the first for that, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So is this a way to bring in more partners or what?
Absolutely. We see the organizations in this region as a huge asset that's, I think, in a lot of ways underutilized, and that they have a lot of knowledge and they have a lot of resources and capacity. And a lot of them do like to work with schools as a way of getting students involved. And we see this as helping to play matchmaker in a way between these organizations and the schools. And it can be very difficult to establish relationships with teachers or parents or whoever. So we see this as the opportunity to bring anyone in this year, next year. If they hear about the event, they can come back. But it's really sort of an open opportunity for anyone that wants to get involved.
We have just about a minute left. I'd like both of you to address this. The teachers, the community organizations, they can devise service projects for the students. But do they learn more if the students, the kids are in on the planning and execution, the sort of the student-led projects, Jennifer?
Yeah, I think there's definitely room for creativity within these sort of off-the-shelf projects. And the attraction of that is that schools are really high-paced environments with competing priorities, and being able, first and foremost, that's, you know, attention to academics. And so some of these environmental efforts sometimes get on a list of things to do another day. So making it very easy and inexpensive is certainly appealing to a school.
Andrew?
I'll just throw out one point of research. The level of retention from students when they experience versus when they are told or listen is much greater, talking about 80% versus something of 5 or 10%. And so getting them involved gives them the ownership and the commitment, again, in that excitement and that inspiration that's going to keep them thinking about this and doing and taking that with them as they go through their life.
So there is a difference between community service and service learning.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'd like to thank you both for coming in. We've been discussing the fourth annual Green Apple Day of Service set for Thursday. Andrew Ellsworth is the director of the Green and Healthy Schools Academy, an initiative of the Green Building Alliance, which coordinates the event. And Jennifer Bales is the Director of Marketing and Public Relations for the Community Day School, who has organized activities for previous Green Apple Days of Service. And that's it for today's Essential Pittsburgh. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. For the Vacationing Paul Guggenheimer, I'm Kevin Gavin. Thanks for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.